someone said among the crowd. Someone find him a fiddle and me a hanky. Glad you're all here with me. Well, most of you anyway. The bridge burners deserved a better way to die. The rider made a derisive sound. Don't be such an idiot, Shapper. In your heads, you've all built us up into something we never were. How quickly you've forgotten. We were mutinous at the best of times. The rest of the time, and that would be almost all the time, we were at each other's throats. Officers getting posted to us would desert first. It was that bad, Fiddler. Look, I ain't done nothing to make this fucking legend, Sergeant. I ain't said a damned thing. You don't have to, and that's just my point. People can talk up anything, can make a snivelling dollop of shit the God's own mountain, given enough time and enough lies and enough silences. I'm a bone hunter now, got nothing to do with any of you anymore, which is what I was trying to tell Hedge. Fine, now go hunt down some bones. Sure, why not? Whose bones do you want us to hunt for? Whiskey Jack rode slightly ahead and swung his mount round, blocking Fiddler's path. But his old sergeant wasn't looking good. He was a damned half-mummified corpse, and his mount wasn't much better off. Whose do you think, Fid? And yet that voice was his, no question. Whiskey Jack. Where'd you come by that name, Fid? And that was Mallet, but he was badly chopped up, the wounds crusted with dried blood. The name? Bone Hunters? It was Finger Bones, I think. Whose hand? What? Nobody's. Lots of people. Nameless ones, long dead ones. Just nameless bones. They were all fading from his vision now, but he wanted them to stay. They were supposed to be here with him, to take up his soul when he died. Whiskey Jack was backing his horse even as he grew translucent. Bones of the fallen, Fiddler. Now, who fell the furthest? Before him now, nothing but that distant flat line. Nothing but the horizon. Fiddler rubbed at his face. Fucking hallucinations. Least they could have done was give me a drink of water. He resumed walking. No reason to. No reason not to. Who fell the furthest? Funny man, Whiskey Jack. But maybe it was so. Maybe she made us and named us to hunt down the bones of a damned god. Maybe she was telling us what she wanted all along, and we were too thick to know it. But look at that line, that perfect flat line, just waiting for our bones to make us ashore. And once we've made it, why, we go no farther. Almost time. Hedge, I'll find you if I can. A few words, a clasp of hands, or a clout upside the head, whichever best suits the moment. Bone Hunters. Oh, nice one. Lostara Yill wanted her god back. She wanted to feel that flow of strength, that appalling will, to take her out of here, to feel a sudden immortal power filling her body, and she would reach out to draw Hanar Vigolf under her shadowy wing. Others too, if she could. This whole army of sufferers, they didn't deserve this. Hanar walked close by her side, ready to steady her when she stumbled. He had seemed indomitable, but now he was bent like an old man. Thirst was crushing them all, like a vast hand pressing down. The adjunct was 10 paces ahead, Banaskar off to her right, and far ahead walked Fiddler, alone. And she imagined she could hear music from him, a siren call pulling them ever forward. But his fiddle was broken. There was no music, no matter what she thought she heard, just the sluggish dirge of her own blood, the rasps of their breaths and the crunch of their worn boots on the hard ground. The jade strangers hung now over the northern sky, casting confused shadows. Those terrible slashes would circle round over the course of the day, now visible even through the sun's bright glare, making the light eerie, unearthly. The adjunct's march was unsteady, drifting to the right for a time, and then back to the left. It seemed only Fiddler was capable of managing a straight line. She remembered back to the reading. its wild violence. Had it all been for nothing? A rush of possibilities, not one realized, not one borne out in the days to follow. It seemed the adjunct, who alone warranted no card, had taken them all from their destinies, taken them into a place with no end but death, and a death bereft of glory or honour. If that was so, then Fiddler's Reading had been the cruelest of jokes. Was he walking out there, ahead of the rest of them, out of some desperate desire, to drag them all into the truth of his visions? But the desert still stretched empty. Not even the bones of the children of the snake could be seen. They had lost them. But no one knew precisely when, and the path that might have led them to the mythical city of Icarius was now nowhere to be seen. Her gaze found the adjunct again, this woman she had chosen to follow, and she didn't know what to think. Beyond Tavare, the horizon, pale as the water of a tropical sea, now showed a rim of fire, announcing the end of the night, the end of this march. Shadows spun round. Fiddler halted. He turned round to face them all. The adjunct continued until she was 10 paces from him and then slowed, and with her last step she tottered and almost fell. Banaskar moved close but stopped when Tavare straightened once more. Enar took hold of Lostara's left arm, and they were still, and she looked down at the ground as if to make it familiar to her eyes, knowing that from this place she would not move, ever again. Not her, not Henar. This is my grave. The Fists and their officers were arriving, Faridan Sort with Scannero, and beside her, Ruthan Gud. Kindly, his face puffy and red, as if he'd stumbled and driven it into something. Raband standing close, one hand on his sword as he eyed Fist Blistig. That man, Lostara saw, had taken a punch. The evidence was plain in his swollen, misaligned nose, his split lips and the smears of dried blood. Bruises had spread out under his reddened eyes, and it seemed as if those eyes were nailed to the adjunct, fevered, burning with malice. Behind them all, the army slowly ground down into something motionless, and she could see the faces of the nearest soldiers, this legion of old men and old women, all staring. Equipment bags slumped to the ground. A few, here and there, followed their kit to the ground. It's done, then. All eyes were on the adjunct. Tavare Paran suddenly looked small, a person none would notice on a street or in a crowd. The world was filled with such people. They bore no proof of gifts, no lines of beauty or grace, no bearing of confidence or challenge. The world is filled with them. Filled, forever unnoticed, forever unwitnessed. Her plain face was ravaged by the sun, blistered and cracked. The weight she had lost made her gaunt, shrunken. Yet she stood, weathering this multitude of stares, the rising heat of hatred, as every need was refused, as every hope was answered with nothing but silence. Now the T'lani Mas arrived. They held their weapons of stone in their lifeless hands, drawing closer to the adjunct. Blistig snarled.
Bodyguards, bitch! Can they kill us all? We'll get to you, I swear it.
The adjunct studied the man, but said nothing.
Please, Tavare, give us some words, give us something, to make this dying palatable. We tried, didn't we? We followed where you led. That was duty, that was loyalty, and all you kept asking of us, the battles, the marches, we did them. See how many have died for you, Tavare. See us who remain. Now we too will die, because we believed. Gods below, say something!
The adjunct twisted round to where Fiddler was standing, and then she faced Ruthan Gud.
Captain!
Her voice was a dull croak.
Where lies Icarius?
South and east of us, adjunct. 9-10 days.
And directly east? Where is the edge of this desert?
He clawed at his beard and then shook his head.
Another 10-11 days if we continue angling northeast.
If we continue following this shallow basin as we have been doing since yesterday.
Is there water beyond the desert, Captain?
On the Ilan Plain? Not much, I would warrant, or so the children have told us. Tavare looked to the Tlani Mas.
Upon the Ilan Plain, Barok, can you find us water?
One of the undead creatures faced her.
Adjunct, we are then within the influence of Akrast Kovalain. It is possible, but difficult, and the efforts we make will be felt. We would not be able to hide.
I understand. Thank you, Barok.
She still thinks we can make it. 10 more days. Has she lost her mind?
Blistig laughed, a sound like the tearing open of his own throat.
We have followed a madwoman. Where else would she lead us?
Lastara could not understand where Blistig found the energy for his rage, but he now raised his arms, shouted,
Malazans! She gave us nothing! We pleaded, we begged, in the name of our soldiers, in the name of all of you, we begged her!
He faced the army.
You saw us marching to her tent again and again. All our questions she spat back into our faces. Our fears, our concerns, they told us this desert was impassable, but she ignored them all.
Before him stood the ranks, and from them not a sound. Blistig spun, advanced on the adjunct.
What power is this within you, woman, that they now die without a complaint?
Kindly, Raband, Sort, and Scannero had all drawn closer. And all at once Lastara knew that if Blistig sought to attack Tavare now, he would never reach her, never mind the Tlani Mas. Yet for all that, those officers kept looking to the adjunct, and Lastara saw the yearning in their eyes. No one could withstand this much longer. Even a god would fall to his knees. But still the adjunct stood.
Beneska, she said.
The ex-priest limped over to Lastara.
Captain, he said, your kit bag, please.
She frowned at him.
What? Can I have your kit bag, Captain?
Hanar helped her lift it off her shoulders. They set it down. Kneeling before it, Banaskar fumbled at the straps.
She judged you the strongest, he murmured. Gift of a god? Possibly. Or,
and he glanced up at her,
maybe you're just the most stubborn one of us all.
He pulled back the sun-cracked flap, rummaged inside, and then drew out a small wooden box. Lastara gasped.
That's not...
You stayed close, Banaskar said. We knew you would.
He struggled to straighten, nodding his thanks when Lastara helped him, and then he walked slowly over to the adjunct. In Lastara's mind... A memory, a throne room. That cedar, the king.
Complaining. Such a plain gift, that dagger. And what did the cedar tell her? Dire necessity.
Banaskar opened the box. The adjunct reached in, withdrew the dagger. She held it before her.
When blood is required, when blood is needed...
Tavare glanced over at her, and Lastara realized that she had spoken those words aloud. Banaskar said,
Adjunct, the king's cedar is an elder god, yes.
Tavare continued studying the knife, and then slowly she looked up, her gaze moving from one face to the next, and something flickered in her expression, that parched mask of plainness, a crack through to...
To such hurt.
And then it was gone again, and Lastara wondered if she'd ever seen it, wondered if she'd imagined the whole thing.
She is only what you see, and what you see isn't much.
Banaskar said,
Your blood, adjunct.
She saw Fiddler then, well behind the adjunct, saw him turn away as if in shame. The adjunct was studying them all. Lastara found herself at Tavare's side, with no memory of moving, and she saw the faces before her, all fixed upon the adjunct. She saw their broken lips, the glint of unbearable need in their eyes. And beside her, in a voice that could crush stones, Tavare Paran said,
"Haven't you drunk enough?"
Fiddler could hear music, filled with such sorrow that he felt everything breaking inside. He would not turn round, would not watch, but he knew when she took that knife and cut deep into her hand. He felt it as if that hand was his own. The blood was bright on that simple iron blade, covering the faint swirling etching. He could see it in his mind's eye. There was no need to lift his head, no need to look over at them all. The way they stood, the thirst and the wound she had delivered so raw in their eyes. And then, in the weight of a silence too vast to comprehend, blood flowing, the adjunct fell to her knees. When she drove that knife into the hard ground, Fiddler flinched, and the music deepened its timbre, grew suddenly faint, and then, in a whisper, returned to him. His knees were cold. Lastariel lifted her head. Were they killing the last of the horses? She'd not even known that any were left, but now she could hear them, somewhere in the mass of soldiers. Stepping forward, her boots skidded. Beside her, Henar cursed under his breath, but not in anger, in wonder. Now voices cried out, and the sound rippled through the army. There was a whispering sound from below, and she looked down. The ground was dark, stained. Wet. Banaskar was at the adjunct's side, lifting her to her feet.
"Fists," he snapped. "Have them ready the casks. Move it."
Water welled up beneath them, spread over the ground. As the sun's light brightened, Lostara could see on all sides a glistening tide flowing ever outward. Through the holes and tears in her boots, she could now feel it, cold, almost numbing, rising to her ankles.
What did Ruthengard say? We're in a basin? How deep is this going to get?
She fell to her knees, drew her head down, and like an animal in the wilds, she drank. And still the water rose. Chaos in the army, laughter, howls, voices lifted to gods. She knew there would be those, fools, who drank too much too quickly and it would kill them. But there were officers and sergeants and hands would be stayed. Besides, most of the fools were already dead. With casks full, with all the waterskins heavy and sweating, could they march another 11 days? They would eat now and soak in as much water as they could. They would feel strength return to their limbs. Their thoughts would awaken from the sluggish torpor they had known for days now. Still the water rose. Horns sounded, and suddenly the bone hunters were on the move, seeking high ground. For all they knew, that knife had delivered an entire sea. Thick as blood, the smell of water filled the air. Book 7. Your Private Shore. Lie still. The jagged, urgent heat, the horn-twisted acts so unconscionable. I have run far from the mob, torn the veil and bled in holes under your very feet. Take my word, not for a day, not a year, not a century. What I will say charges the echo of 1,000 years unchained, and all the pillagers of derision, pacing the mouths of caves, march legions of dust, back and forth, like conquerors, and the juddering ways, the skittered agitations, the bridled and the umbraged. My tears appease not your thirst. My blood was never for you. I am running still, alone as I have ever been, and this kissing air on my face, from here to forever, is clean and pure as wonder. Legions of Dust, Atalict. Chapter 21. He was not a modest man. Contemplating suicide, he summoned a dragon. Gothos Folly. Gothos.
Even should you succeed, Cassilian, beyond all expectation, beyond even all desire, they will still speak of your failure.
He stood in the place where the whirl had manifested, a wounding in the fabric of shadow, a place now slowly healing. There was nothing else here, nothing to give evidence to the struggles that had occurred, the blood that had been spilled. Still, chaos felt closer than it ever had, as if moments from erupting once again. The madness of sorcerers, the ambitions of the starved. We're surrounded by fools wanting more than what they have. And alas, it's all too familiar company, and the ugly truth is that we may not be out of place in that crowd. Edgewalker's words haunted him. The breathtaking ambition, the sheer verve of all that they had set in motion. But now we have finally arrived. It's all cut loose, and so much, so much is out of our hands. He saw footprints in the grey dust, reminding him that there were other arenas, distant places where battles raged on. Nothing was simple, and in the spilling of blood no one could guess the myriad channels it would carve. Shadow Throne, old friend, we have done what we could. But the game is much bigger than we ever imagined. This gamble, gods, this gamble. One hand drifted to one of the knives at his belt, and then he shook himself, straightening. Take a deep breath, lad. Here goes.
What you ask of me, it is too much. Yes, of course, I see the necessity. I may have sickened, even threatened, but magic is not my enemy. It never was. Indeed, I envy its gifts to this world. Upon my own, no matter. Belief can be rotten. All it takes is one betrayal to steal away an entire future. You would not have recognized me in my anger. It shone blinding bright. There remain those among the multitudes I left behind who imagine themselves gods for all their mortal trappings. They would maintain a tyranny such as no true god could ever imagine. They would enslave generation upon generation, all those sharing the same soil, the same water, the same air. They conspire to keep them on their knees, bowed in servitude. And each slave, measuring his or her life, can see, if they dare, only the truth. And so most of my world, most of my children, live a life of despair and suffering and ever-growing rage. Is this all there must be? The tyrants would have it so. I sometimes dream. Yes, I know you have little time. I dream of returning, swords blazing with holy vengeance. I dream, Shadow Throne, of murdering every one of those fuckers. Is this what it means to be a god? To be an implacable weapon of justice? Wouldn't that be nice? I agree. No, I'm not that much of a fool. It will be no different. And should you achieve the impossible with your handful of mortals, should you free me and find the path, the moment I take my first step upon the soil of my home, they will emasculate me, bleed me, gut me, and then stretch my hide overhead. They'll need shade from the torrid heat of all the fires they themselves lit. That is the problem with tyrants. They outlive us all. I will do what you ask. Rather, I shall try. Pieces of me remain missing, and I despair of ever seeing them again. It is my understanding that the one named Skinner, usurper and tyrant king of my house of chains,
has many enemies. He can now count me among them. Do you imagine he loses sleep? No, I don't either. Betrayers never do. Shadow Throne, you will not betray me, will you?
Karsa Orlong, where are all the gods of peace?
He stepped outside, straightening.
I know not.
Picker turned to face the city. Many troubles there. Perhaps at last they had begun to settle, but all that boiled beneath the surface, well, that never went away.
Do you know how to get there?
He eyed her.
I know how to get there.
She drew a deep breath. She could hear movement inside the hut behind the giant. Picker lifted her gaze until it locked with the Toblakai's.
I call upon the vow you made long ago, Karsa Orlong of the Teblor. When you walk to where you must go, a crippled priest will find you. In the street, a broken man, a beggar, and he will speak to you, and by his words you shall understand.
I already understand, Malazan.
Karsa,
there are too many gods of war.
And then he took up his sword, and inside the hut a woman began weeping.
And not one of them understands the truth.
Karsa!
His teeth were bared as he said,
When it comes to war, woman, who needs gods?
She watched as he set off, and under her breath she whispered,
Darujistan, I beg you, do not get in this man's way.
Dust roiled over the distant encampment. Squinting, Paran took another bite of the alien fruit his foragers had found and wiped at the juices dribbling down into his beard.
That is not helping, Hyphist.
He glanced over. Ormulogan was scratching desperately on a bleached board with his willow charcoal stick. At his feet squatted a fat toad, watching his efforts with gimlet eyes.
Nothing will help that, the toad sighed.
Posterity, snapped the imperial artist.
Posterity, my ass, Gumble replied. Oh, was that not droll of me? Critics are never appreciated for what they truly are.
What? Leeches sucking on the talents of others, you mean?
It is my objectivity that you so envy, Ormulogan.
And you, the artist muttered, can stick that objectivity up your posterity, toad.
Paran took a last bite of the fruit, examined the furry pit, and then flung it over the wall. He wiped his hands on his thighs and turned.
Fist writhe bued.
The woman was leaning out over a parapet. She straightened.
Sir?
Assemble the companies at their stations. It's time.
Aye, sir.
Lounging nearby, Noto Boyle drew the fish spine from between his front teeth and stepped forward.
Is it truly?
Weapons, said Paran, kept hidden away. But there comes a time, Noto, when they must be unsheathed. A time, in fact, to put proof to the pretensions.
He eyed the cutter.
The gods have been kicking us around for a long time. When do we say enough?
And in their absence, Hyphist, will we manage things any better?
No, Paran said, walking past him. But at least then we won't have the option of blaming someone else.
Sister Belai scanned the distant walls. Suddenly, not a soldier in sight.
They've quit, she said. Now, the question is, do they leave the way they came, or do they march out from the gate, or what's left of it, and try to break the siege?
Standing beside her, watered exigent glanced back at the camp.
If the latter, sister, then we are perhaps in trouble.
Sister Belai pretended not to hear him. If his seed of doubt thirsted for water, he would have to find it elsewhere.
Another week, that is all we need. And then Brother Serenity will be here with 5,000 heavily armored foreigners.
The besieging forces were damaged. That last assault had been brutal. She was down to half strength. Her hold on them was fragile, and this was not a familiar feeling.
I see no movement at the gate, Sister Belai.
There was a barrier to dismantle, and that would take time.
But I feel it. They're coming for us.
Assemble the companies, Exigent. That gate is the bottleneck. If we can lock them there, we hold them until they're exhausted, too mauled to force the issue.
And if they break us instead?
She turned, studied him.
Do you doubt the power of my will? Do you imagine that this master of the deck can manage anything more than fending me off? I will not yield, Exigent. Understand that. And if it means that every single one of our Shriven and every single one of their watered commanders ends up a corpse on the field, then so be it.
Watered Exigent paled, and then he saluted.
I will inform the commanders that we shall advance.
Have them ready, Exigent. The command to advance shall be mine and mine alone.
Of course, Sister Belai.
After he had left, she returned her attention to the keep. Still no activity at the barricade.
Perhaps my feeling about this is wrong. Perhaps indeed he flees through a warren, and just like that, the siege is done. But he will return. Somewhere. This thorn is yet to leave our side, I am certain of it.
Her eyes narrowed, and she blinked rapidly to clear a sudden blurring of her vision. But the problem was not with her eyes. To either side of the barricaded gate, the massive walls had grown strangely smudged all along the breadths, as if stone had become water. And from these places, troops appeared in formation, and then skirmishers and archers fanning out from main ranks. The five deep lines then unfolded and began linking up with those to either side. Cavalry thundered into view on the far left flank, riding hard for a rise to the west. She heard the shouts of confusion from her commanders, felt the recoiling fear of the Shriven.
He opened gates through the walls. He knew we would be studying the barricade, waiting for them to begin dismantling it. He knew we wouldn't advance until they did so. And now we are not ready.
Sister Belai swung round.
Form a line! Form a line!
My voice will take their souls, and I will drive the Shriven forward like wolves unleashed. They will ignore their wounds, their fear. They will think only of slaughter. By the time my last soldier falls, the enemy will have ceased to be a military threat. This I swear.
She saw her watered commanders taking control of their companies, their voices powerful as iron-toothed whips. She could feel it now, the cold, implacable sorcery of Akrast Corvalane gathering, and she was pleased at its burgeoning strength. And then someone shrieked, and Sister Belai staggered.
What? I have lost one of my commanders! How?
She saw a swirl of soldiers closing in to where one of the watered had been standing a moment earlier. Terror and confusion rippled outward. 40 paces distant from that scene, another commander suddenly died, his chest blossoming wounds.
They have infiltrated assassins!
She awakened her voice.
Find them! Assassins, find them!
The companies were in chaos.
Facing ranks, prepare for the enemy!
She saw Exigent, heard his shouts as he struggled to reassert order on his milling Shriven. As she moved to join him, there was a blossom of darkness behind the man. Sister Belai shrieked a warning, but too late. Knives sank home. Exigent arched in shock and then was falling.
Akrast Corvalane, I call upon your power!
She set off down the slope. The darkness had vanished, but then, as magic heightened her vision, she could see its swirling path. There would be no hiding from her, not now.
A mage! How dare he! No power but mine!
And she saw that whirling black cloud stagger, saw it pinned in place, writhing in sudden panic. Hands twitching in anticipation, she advanced on it. Off to her right, she could hear the enemy's horns announce the attack. She would deal with that later.
I can still save this. I must.
The darkness convulsed in the grip of her power. Now only 6 paces between her and the hidden mage.
No power but mine!
The sorcery erupted, vanished with a thunderous detonation, and she saw before her a man staggering, sinking down to his knees. Dark-skinned, bald, gaunt.
Not the master of the deck.
No matter, she would rend him limb from limb. 4 paces, her boots crunching on gravel, and he looked up at her and smiled. Got you. She did not even hear her killer as he came up behind her, but the long knives that burst from her chest lifted her from her feet. She twisted, balanced on 2 hilts, as her slayer raised her yet higher. Then, with a low grunt, he flung her to one side. She was thrown through the air, landing hard, rolling across sharp stones. The bastard had severed the veins beneath both her hearts, and now, lying in her last moments, her head lolled, and she saw him. Burly, ebon-skinned, the long-bladed knives dripping in his hands. Her watered were all dead. She heard the enemy ranks smashing into her disordered forces. She heard the slaughter begin. Faintly, she caught the mage speaking to the assassin.
"Sheathe that Ototaril blade, Callum, and be quick about it."
And he rumbled a reply. "Done. Now, make me invisible again." Their voices grew more distant.
"Do you think it's easy? She damned near broke my back with that command."
They were walking away.
"Just feeling a tad exposed here, quick. Behind enemy lines and all."
"What lines?"
Sister Belai closed her eyes.
"Ototaril? You unsheathed Ototaril? Oh, you fool."
And these, her last thoughts, bubbled with a kind of dark pleasure. The enemy, broken, routed, war leader Mathok rode up to Paran's position near the westernmost rise and reined in.
"High fist! The last have fled east, down into the valley. Shall we pursue?"
"No,"
Paran replied, watching as Quick Ben and Kalam approached from across the killing field.
"Mathok, begin gathering up forage for your horses. Send parties deeper into the valley if needed. But for resupply only, no chasing down. I fear we shall have to ride hard now."
"Where?"
"South, Mathok, south."
The war leader wheeled his mount round, yelling commands at his second, Tmoral, who waited a short distance back with a wing of cavalry and then rode off in the direction of his main force. Mathok's raiders had been eager, and they had acquitted themselves well. Watching the war leader ride away, Paran rubbed at the back of his neck.
"No wonder you winced at every move, Dujek,"
he said under his breath.
"I'm a mess of knotted ropes."
Still, the enemy broke at first contact, and what could have been a nasty scrap turned into a slaughter. A mere handful of casualties, and most of those from idiots falling on weapons in their haste to pursue. Ensorcelled voices were all very well, but if that was where all the discipline and courage came from,
now we can see the flaw in that, can't we?
"Hey, fist," said Quick Ben, walking up like a man who'd taken a beating.
His face was drawn, his eyes skittish with something that might be pain. Paran nodded.
"Hi, mage. Was it as bad as it looks?"
"Not really. Just out of practice. Lost touch with being subtle, I think."
A curious thing to say, Paran reflected, and then he faced Callum. The assassin's weapons were sheathed, and he looked rather pleased with himself. For no reason he cared to discover, Paran found he wanted to take that smugness down a notch or two. "You've been killing people after all." He regarded him for a moment longer before saying,
"Your wife wishes your attention."
The man scowled.
"Now?"
"That was easy.
Since you're covered in blood, Corporal, you might want to wash first."
Quick Ben snorted.
"I'd forgotten, Callum. You're a lowly corporal, meaning I can order you around." "Just try it, you hood-bitten snake."
After the assassin had left them, the High Mage turned to Paran, hesitated, and then said,
"Felt something far to the southwest."
"As did I, Quick Ben."
That skittish look returned.
"Do you know what it was? Do you?"
The High Mage sighed.
"Back to that, then, is it?"
Paran cocked his head.
"When I asked Shadow Throne for Kalam, I admit that I didn't expect you to be the delivery man. My last sense of you was in the company of my sister's army, keeping your head down."
Quick Ben nodded, looking thoughtful.
"You were able to sniff out things like that? I'm impressed, Gallows Paran. You have come a long way from the nervous, gut-sick captain I remember from Black Coral."
"I'm still gut-sick, High Mage," he said. "And as for sensing distant powers, alas, that's been growing ever more uncertain. And obviously, since coming within the influence of the Asael Warren, I have been effectively blind. But with my sister, it was never easy in the best of circumstances."
"Her sword."
"Her sword, yes. And other things."
Quick Ben's nod was sympathetic.
"Sister's eye."
Then his gaze sharpened.
"That manifestation we felt, do you think, was it her?"
Paran frowned. Just the mention of his stomach had delivered a nip of pain, and then vague nausea, reluctant to fade.
"And look at us, still stepping round each other. Forget all that, Paran. Be honest, see what happens."
"I don't know, High Mage, but I mean to find out."
Quick Ben studied the mass of soldiers moving through the enemy supplies, and then he rubbed at his eyes.
"Genos Paran, what are we? Here, what are we?"
Paran felt his face twisting as anxiety gnawed again at his stomach.
"Quick Ben, we're soldiers of the Emperor. It's all we ever have been."
Quick Ben shot him a look.
"You were just a child when he ruled."
Paran shrugged. "Nonetheless."
"Aye,"
the High Mage muttered like a man trying to swallow bad news.
"Nonetheless. But that empire is gone, Paran, if it ever existed at all."
"Now that's a sharp observation. Nothing lasts, Quick Ben. Speaking of which, how do you warrant Kalam and Minala's chances?"
Quick Ben grunted, and the sound might have been wry laughter or sympathy.
"I don't. And while I think they'd be good together, they keep trying to wear each other's skin, if you know what I mean."
"Sort of."
"It's not love that's the problem.
It's all the rest."
Quick Ben nodded, and then he shrugged.
"So tell me, O Master of the Deck of Dragons, what awaits us now?"
"That depends."
"On what?"
"Gods below, where do I begin?"
"Start with the worst it could get."
"The worst? How much do you already know?"
Quick Ben rubbed vigorously at his face as if trying to rearrange his own features.
"And maybe become someone else."
"Not as much as you might believe,"
he said.
"Shadow Throne's not yet gotten over some past slight I offered him, though for the life of me I can't recall what it might have been. In any case, we're not exactly whispering in each other's ear."
"Still," Paran said, not quite convinced.
"Well, you have to understand, I usually work alone, and if I need help, I make sure the bargain I make is mutually beneficial. To keep down the chances of taking a knife in the back. I admit it, High Fist, I really trust no one."
"No one at all?"
"The trust I have, for some people, comes down to how well I know them. And then it's a matter of my trusting them to do what I think they're going to do."
"It's a rather cynical take on trust," Paran observed.
"It's the safest. It doesn't take much insight to realize that most people are only looking out for themselves. And once you figure out what they want, you can manipulate them."
The wizard shrugged.
"Am I that much of a mystery? I have 12 souls in me. Think about that. All those lives, all those desires, regrets, hurts. Whatever you feel about your life, I have that a dozen times over.
and some of those souls in me are old. Yet of necessity you all have to work together for a common purpose, if you say so. Paran studied the man. Mystery? What mystery? Right. Very well. The worst? Here goes, then. Kurald Galain falls to vengeful Tist Leosan, and they walk that path right into the heart of Shadow, ousting Shadow Throne, and from there they march onward to this world, joining with the Fokrul Asael in a tide of slaughter, until not one city is left standing, not one field planted, not one human child born into the world. Do you want the rest?
There's more.
The Elder Gods, having at last freed the Ototeral Dragon, succeed in the annihilation of magic, barring that paid for in blood, unless, of course, Carabas is killed. But if that happens, it will mean that the Elaint, who are now or will soon be loose in this realm, will have killed it. And they will in turn seek domination, not just of this realm, but of all realms, delivering chaos wherever they go. And so, even with us wiped from the earth, terrible powers will contest the claim to our legacy. The gods will be dead, magic athirst only fools would dare invite, and, well, should I go on? Quick Ben licked dry lips.
Parts of Burn are dying. On our way here, whenever we touched the soil of this world, I could feel her skin searing, drying and shriveling into something lifeless. The Ototeral Dragon, yes. I probably already knew that, Quick Ben muttered, just trying not to think about it and hoping it would all go away. Hood's breath! Ganos Paran, tell me what we can do to prevent all this!
The High Fist's brows rose. How unfortunate. That is the question I was going to ask you, Quick Ben.
That's not funny.
Wasn't meant to be.
Your sister?
Aye, my sister. You were with her, wizard? She must have explained her plan. Quick Ben looked away.
She would free the crippled god.
And that's it?
How should I know? Was your whole family like her? Nobody saying a damned thing to each other? Dead silence at the dinner table? Is that how you managed to get along, assuming you got along in the first place?
Paran grimaced. Can't say we did much. Got along, I mean.
What might she be holding inside?
I wish I knew. Quick Ben's growing agitation was evident in his waving hands, his sudden pacing, the sharp, wide-eyed looks he threw at Paran.
I thought you two had this planned!
Had what planned?
You're the master of the deck of dragons!
So I am. Why? You want to play? For a moment, it seemed Quick Ben's eyes would burst from their sockets, and then, with sudden hope...
A reading! Yes, that's it! I'd take a damned reading right now. Why not?
But Paran was shaking his head. You don't want that, High Mage. Trust me, you don't. There are too many rogue players in this game. Icarium, Draconis, the First Sword of the T'lani Mas, Olar Ethil, Silchas Ruin, Tulas Shorn, Kilava, even Gruntle, the mortal sword of Treach. And now the Elaint, and how many dragons have come or are coming through the gate? 100? 1,000? Oh, and the Elder Gods, Erastus, the past master of the tiles, and Kilmandaros and her son. Quick Ben was staring as if Paran had lost his mind. Paran scowled. What now?
They're all here?
I have the deck of dragons in my damned skull, remember? I caught the first winds of convergence some time ago. Trust me when I say this will be the biggest the world has ever seen, bigger even than the chaining of the crippled god. Nobody said it'd be easy, High Mage. The question is, what do you have to offer me? Quick Ben snarled.
Why, more good news. What did you think?
What do you mean? The High Mage threw up his hands.
Let's just add the Kachin Chimal and the Jaghut. And, oh, we should probably mention Hood himself, no longer dragging the throne of death by one ankle.
And who knows how many slavering fanatics of the Wolves of Winter? And what about the crippled god himself? Will he go quietly? Why should he? If I was him, even if you showed me the inviting door at the far end, I'd be slicing throats all the way down the corridor. I'd have damn well earned the right to as much vengeance as I could muster.
Haran grunted. All right, it's rather more complicated than I had imagined then. Quick Ben seemed to choke on his reply. After a bout of coughing and then spitting, he shook his head and, eyes watering, he rubbed at his face again. Then he took a deep, settling breath and said,
"We need a secret weapon, Paran."
"I have a gut feeling about that."
"The one burning a hole in your stomach?"
"I hope not." "I think we might have two secret weapons, High Mage."
"Please, I am begging you, go on."
"Quick, Ben, tell me, who was the toughest bridge burner you ever knew? Think back and think carefully. Get your ego out of the way. Ignore your favorites and the ones who spent all their time looking mean. Not the callous shits, not the backstabbers, none of the posers. The toughest, Quick Ben. Day in, day out, good times, bad. Tell me, who?" The High Mage squinted, glanced down at the ground at his feet, and then he sighed and nodded, looking up as he said,
"I didn't need that list, Ganos. I knew my answer right from the start. We all knew."
"Who?"
"Fiddler. There's no tougher man alive."
Paran looked away. "My family. Aye, we were something of a mess. But I will tell you this. This one thing I know without any doubt, and it starts with a memory. My sister had an area of ground cleared for her at the country estate, and it was where, beginning when she was barely 5 years old, she used toys to fight battles from every history book and scroll she could find. And the times when my father entertained high fists in his horse-selling ventures, he'd make it a kind of challenge to those veteran commanders. Take to the field against little sallow-faced Tavaray, with all those toy soldiers. Count your attrition honestly and see what happens. My sister, Quick Ben, from about 7 onward, never lost to a single commander. And when their corpses were dragged away, she went deeper into the histories. She started taking the losers' sides, and then won those too."
"Tavaray, then."
"Think of all the great military leaders, Dasem, Coltane, Kaz, Dujek, Greymane. For what it is worth, I would pit my sister against any of them. Gods below, against all of them." He continued staring into the southwest. "There you have it, High Mage. Fiddler and my sister, our two weapons." When he looked back, he saw Quick Ben studying him. The High Mage said,
"The ascended bridge burners hold the gates of death."
"I know.
Except for Hedge. Whiskey Jack sent Hedge back to Fiddler."
"Did he now?"
"Remember Pale, Ganos Paran?"
"As much of it as I could, which wasn't much."
"Right. You weren't there yet. Not when we got together on a hill outside the city to shake things down one more time. Or if you were around, sorry was sticking a dagger in your back about then."
"What about it, Quick?"
"It's just, we were all there, trying to make sense of things. And now I've got this feeling we're all going to meet again, to bring it all to an end."
"One way or another?"
"Aye."
"How do you gauge our chances, High Mage?"
"Miserable."
"And our weapons?"
"With me vouching for Fiddler and you for your sister," he said with a wry grin, "the best we could hope for, I suppose."
"And here I have two more. The infamous Callum and Quick Ben. You know, if I wasn't such a realist, I'd be feeling confident right now." A scowl replaced the grin.
"Did you really have to put it quite that way, High Fist?"
He felt her eyes on him as he swung onto the horse, Settling in the saddle, gathering the reins, he squinted at the broad, terraced valley stretching away to his right. Rich lands, he mused. Then he glanced across at her. What? Minala shook her head.
He's going to get you killed for real one of these days. You know that, don't you?
Kalam snorted. Whatever you think you've seen, Minala, you'll just have to take my word. You really have no idea what we've survived, me and Quick.
Fine. Impress me.
Probably not possible, but I'll try anyway. Jaghut and Crimson Guard avowed in Mott Wood. Tistandi assassin mages and highborn demons in Darujistan. More claw than you could count. Looking across at her, seeing her flat expression, he sighed. And we ain't so bad on our own, either. Icarium, the Panion Domine, Kachain Naruk, and Soul-Taken Dragons. Quicks faced down them all. As for me, if I could raise up every person and every demon and every whatever I've personally killed, I'd have an army big enough to drown the Fokrul Asael in piss. Never mind a knockdown fight. She continued staring at him, and then she said, inflectionless,
You are both insufferable.
Some nerve, he rumbled, after all that attention I just gave you. On all sides, Paran's host was forming up, preparing to march. They had a third of a day's light left, and it seemed the High Fist wasn't much interested in resting his troops. In a hurry, that's always bad. Decent-looking soldiers, though. Lots of North Jenabakan and Malazan mainlanders. And then there's those Seven Cities horse warriors, tribals. Tribals always scared me. Minala took a drink from her water skin and then spoke again.
Were all you bridge burners the same? Arrogant, self-important, narcissistic?
Aye, and we earned every strut.
Rubbish.
In fact, Kalam went on, ignoring her comment, it's probably why they decided to wipe us out. Every officer they threw at us couldn't hold up. We were a company run by the sergeants, Whiskey Jack first and foremost, but even then the sergeants voted on stuff, the orders they'd give to the captains and lieutenants, the orders to go down to the rest of us. As you might imagine, the high command didn't much like that. Oh, we might listen to a few, the ones we knew would do right by us, Dasim, Dujek, the ones we knew were worth their salt, but the rest, not a chance.
Meaning you were ungovernable.
Meaning we were actually thinking of taking down the Empress. Aye, looking on it that way, Lassine had to wipe us out. She had no choice, and if it didn't sit well with her, having to kill off her toughest soldiers, well, I suppose we gave her few options.
Well, now, Minala said, finally a little honesty.
So now I'm with the host, wife. Which brings me to the question, what are you doing here? It ain't safe wherever we're going.
Shadowthrone's children, she said. Those that survived, I mean. I couldn't look them in the eye, not after what happened. I couldn't bear it any longer. And I could see Cotillion and Shadowthrone. They were up to something. But mostly, she seemed to shudder, the children and what happened outside the throne room. I'll grant you, Quick Ben didn't hesitate. Even when it looked like he was going to die, he didn't hesitate.
Icarium, Kalam muttered. Maybe one day I'll face off against him and we'll see. Minala snorted.
That'd put a quick end to your arrogance, Kalam Mekar.
A signaller waved a banner, and it was time to ride down to join the vanguard. Kalam thought about Minala's last words and sighed. They kicked their horses into motion, and Kalam asked,
Love, tell me again about that Tist Edur with the spear.
Commander Erekala of the Grey Helms entered the tent to find Brother Serenity standing in a corner at the back, draped in shadows and facing the canvas wall. There was no one else present, and Erekala was brought up short.
Pure?
Serenity slowly turned.
Have you ever been buried alive, Erekala? No, I would imagine not. Perhaps in the occasional nightmare. No matter. Earlier this day, I felt the murder of Sister Belai, and every one of her officers all dead. The siege has been shattered, and our enemy is now loose within our domain.
Erekala blinked, but said nothing.
Take off your helm, Serenity said. Do you see, over there, a carafe, foreign wine? I admit to having acquired a taste for it. It serves well in easing my misgivings.
And he went over to pour himself a goblet. He poured a second goblet and gestured to it. Helm now unstrapped and under one arm, Erekala shook his head and said, Misgivings, Pure? Is not the cause just?
Oh, indeed, Erekala. There will be justice in our tide of retribution. But there will also be crime. We do not spare the children. We do not ask them to remake their world, to fashion a new place of humility, respect, and compassion. We give them no chance to do better.
Pure, said Erekala, as the teachings of the wolves make plain, each and every generation is given a new chance, and each time they but perpetuate the crimes of their fathers and mothers. From the blow that strikes the innocent child to the one that lays waste to a forest, while the magnitude of the gesture may vary, the desire behind the hand does not. So the wild would say, if it but had the words to speak. Serenity's eyes glittered in the shadows.
And you see no presumption?
Erekala cocked his head. Pure, the presumptions of the Perish Greyhelms are unending. Yet if we refuse, or are unable to comprehend the suffering of the innocent, be it babe or beast, what do our words replace, if not all that we would not hear, would not countenance, lest it force us to change our ways, which we will never do? If we would speak for the wild, we must begin with the voice of human conscience, and when conscience is not heeded, or is discarded, then what choice remains to us?
How clearly you enjoy such debate, Erekala. You remind me of better days, peaceful days. Very well. I will consider what the world would be like for all within it if conscience was more than just a whispering voice. If, indeed, it could raise a hand in anger. And when even a sound beating is not enough, it might then close that hand about a throat and take the life from the transgressor.
It is our greatest presumption, Pure, said Erekala, that we be the hand of conscience.
Holding a sword.
And finally driven to use it, yes. Serenity drained his goblet and replaced it with the other one.
Yet your fellow humans, your victims, could not but see you as evil, as terrible murderers of the innocent. In fact, the very notion of guilt or innocence would be without relevance in their eyes.
If we are to be evil, then we but balance the evil that opposes us.
Seeking negation.
And Serenity smiled. Sister Reverence made us kneel, Pure. But we are not so naive as to have come to you expecting anything but the opportunity to give our lives in the name of that which we believe to be right. You will use us until none of us are left. She did not need to compel the Perish.
I believe you, Erekala. and I find in you and your people much to admire. I will regret sending you all to your death.